Welcome to the AP Now podcast, the podcast that covers trends, insights, and emerging issues impacting every accounts payable function. Your host, Mary Schaefer, is the founder of AP Now, a B2B digital information and learning company focused on all issues related to AP. Stay tuned as Mary and her guests discuss the business intelligence you need to ensure a cost-effective, technologically efficient, fraud-resistant, regulatory-compliant accounts payable function. Without further ado, let's dive right in.
Welcome to episode 32 of the AP Now podcast. I'm Mary Schaefer, and I'm joined again by Steve Mercatanti, who's come to talk to us today about some frequently asked 1099 questions. Today's show is brought to you by Stamply, a leader in AI-powered invoice automation. Welcome back, Steve. I know that you were on the broadcast, the podcast a few weeks ago. Perhaps just for those who missed it, you might just give us a quick overview of your service. And we didn't get to talk about your book last time. So maybe you could just tell us a little bit about your hobby and your spare time, World War II.
Yes. So my company, TIR Consulting, we primarily provide tax reporting, education, and consulting services to a variety of clients across all industries. And I either do on-site consultation for various clients, or I do a lot of webinars and seminars. I also write tax guides, so I don't just write books about world. In my free time, I write books about World War II, and then I write tax guides for work. I have three of them I put out every year. I have a compliance guide for the 1099s, 1042S compliance guide. And then next month, I'll be releasing my filing guide, which is federal 1099, 1042S filing, as well as state reporting. And so one of the cool things about that, I've been working on this this guide for, 12, 13 years now. And so and because of the changes in the law, probably 30, 40% of the content turns over year over year. But the other thing, the nice thing is when you work at something for a really long time, even if it seems like a massive project at first, you really knock a lot out. And so in that regard, on the state level, I have one of the only sources around of all of the state 1099 reporting rules. Because remember, all the states have different rules.
Yeah.
And so it's not like there's a centralized location where you can find that. And in this guide, I have a series of tables that lay out those rules for each of the 50 states. And that's important because, you know, typically your organization, it's not like you're just doing business generating revenue within a single location. You're probably doing that in a variety of states, or if you're a national organization, then all over the country.
Right.
And so you're required to not only follow IRS reporting rules, but then there's the whole laundry list of different state requirements, be it unclaimed property or sales in use or new hire reporting, or 1099 report.
Right.
And then if you want to make things really difficult, you can also consider the fact that a lot of localities that are within the states have their own reporting. So it's not just that maybe you made this payment to this service provider in New York, but they might be in New York City, or they might not just be in Pennsylvania, they might be in Philly. And those are cities that have their own reporting requirements as well. They might not just be in Michigan, they might be in Detroit, has their own reporting requirements. So then you have reporting at the federal level, at the state level, and at the local level.
Oh my God.
And if we want to make things really difficult, you could say you have this payment to this payee performing services for you in the U.S., and you're not sure if they're a U.S. person or not.
So
and
let's
if
not
they
go down
turn out
that
to
road.
Be non, yeah, you could end up with 1042S reporting.
Oh.
So this is all, it's all connected. And so typically people attend webinars and it's on a specific topic.
Yep.
Or they have a specific question. But the reality is a lot of times so much of this is interconnected. And you know, if you've been at accounts payable for a while, and you've been doing this for a while, then that starts to become clearer. If you're newer to this process, I don't even want you to go there because it's just going to like, it's your head's going to explode.
I never thought I'd hear myself say this, Steve, but I think I'd rather do sales and use tax than W-8s and 1042s.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, too, because sales and use is such a – and especially with – I mean, talk about changes in the law. I mean, sales and use, you had the huge Supreme Court decision last year that basically, you know, put stamp to what the states have been doing for a while, which is establish this economic nexus standard where – it used to be you could say, well, we don't have a physical location there. We don't have to worry about it.
Right.
You know, and for years now, states have been saying, no, if you're doing business generating revenue here, you got an issue.
Right.
And you better take care of that. And the thing is they've all been cracking down. So there was a bit of a Wild West period during the recession or the heart of the recession where the states were in big trouble. And they weren't doing much of anything, but then their budgets came back, you know, the tax base came back, and they have been changing and updating their laws with a vengeance. Mm-hmm. I mean, with an absolute vengeance. I can't even begin to tell you how much the state reporting rules have changed over the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
And in spite of all of that, the 1042S stuff is still more confusing.
You agree with my assessment? You'd rather do
something? Yeah, I mean, and then the other problem is from a federal perspective, that is one of the big action areas the IRS is focused on in terms of enforcement.
Because,
you know, once that payment goes out the door and it gets into that foreign payee's hand, the chances of the IRS being able to claw back any withholding that should have been done but wasn't is really slim.
Yeah.
So that's why they enforce it like you wouldn't believe. That's a huge area of enforcement. And then they, and that's a huge area of penalties. And then it's so bad that a lot of times, too, we've seen evidence over the last few years, there might be 1042, 1042S audits, and it opens up 1099 audits because, of course, you're talking about backup withholding, and if you're talking about backup withholding, a lot of times they'll look at the 945s that your organization file, and then that'll lead them to look at the 1099 miscellaneous box 4s that your organization files. And so now you might have had an audit that started in the 1042S world, and now it's expanded into your 1099 world.
Oh, great.
And so that's been going on for the last few years as well. But yeah, I mean, the whole 1042S situation is something you very much got to be aware of. And a lot of people have been shortchanging it because the forms W-8 haven't changed in a couple of years. And that's rare. Those forms have been changing quite a bit. And in fact, in 4 years ago, we had a brand new W-8 come out. But typically, year over year, they change. And that also tells me then your complacency should really be over because I highly anticipate something's going to change soon.
Okay.
And it has to
because
the other changes on the 1099 side have been so extensive that there's going to have to be an adjustment on the 1042S side.
Yeah.
And to be fair, that gets even more confusing because a lot of people are like, well, 1042S, okay, if I make a payment outside the U.S., but then that could also be 1099 reportable and not 1042S if you're dealing with a U.S. person working abroad.
Right.
And it doesn't have to just be your employee, like your employee working abroad that
covered.
Yeah, but I mean, it could be you have a contractor working abroad and they could very well be a U.S. person.
Yeah.
And that could trigger a 1099 requirement. And believe it or not, it could also trigger a 1042S requirement. Because that bank you're sending that payment to, if it's a foreign bank.
Right.
And so now you're like, holy cow, you know, there's a lot going on there. So, yeah, without a shadow of a doubt, that's incredibly complicated. I actually do an advanced seminar for a selection of my clients, those who are brave enough to take it, every summer. and I actually get a pretty good turnout, but this is going to be – you know, if someone's listening in and they've been doing accounts payable for a decade or two, or they're a CPA who's not just, you know, keeping up with their CPEs for S&Gs, but they're actually trying to really you know, hone in and learn, which most of the CPAs are, then this is the kind of stuff where you're someone who's been doing this for a while and you got really complicated issues or questions. I tie this, all of that together in it.
Okay.
So I have separate, you know, and I do for other companies or myself, I have separate 1042S webinars where I say, hey, that's all we're focusing on today. And then I might have other webinars I do where we're only focusing on sales and use.
Okay.
And others where I only focus on 1099. But this advanced one, this is the one that says, we're going to look at this payment and this payee and the totality of your reporting and compliance and due diligence obligations. And I do a lot of practical examples in that webinar because at that point, I'm expecting the audience knows a lot of the stuff I'm talking about, but there's a difference between knowing something in a book smart kind of way and knowing it in a practical application kind of way.
So when you bring up the question, the issue of questions, Steve, when you know you get asked a lot of them, do you typically get asked the same ones over and over again, or are you constantly throwing curves with new questions?
It's actually a mix. In the webinars, I tend to get the same questions over and over again. From the clients, I get a lot of where they're really going down the road into other 1099s and stuff. So they're getting into 1099Rs and 1099Ss and not so commonly filed forms.
Mm-hmm.
And like, for example, if they're dealing with W-8s, they might have a question about the 8233 or the W-8 ECI or the EXP, not just your basic W-8 BEN, for example.
Right.
And so my clients tend to ask very sophisticated questions. And part of that is because also the easier questions, a lot of those have been, I mean, I've answered them 15-20 different ways over the years. So if they go in to the database and they type in a search, they're going to say, oh yeah, okay, well, here's 15 different directions he's addressed this from. But I might have this particular, very esoteric, you know, 1099R question about, you know, it could be, I don't know, 1035, 1031 exchanges or something like that. And he's answered those, but geez, they just changed all those rules a year ago. So now how does that matter? And he's only answered a few since then. So that I have my question. And then then I take what I know and I do research and then I come back and give them an answer. And in the webinars, they tend to be more of, I get a lot of repeat questions. Probably the most popular one being whenever a new W-9 comes out, without a shadow of a doubt, the most common question I get is, well, what do we do with the old ones? And I invariably I'm like, you know, nothing. They're still valid, you know, so it's cool. I mean, you're good. You don't have to go and, you know, you don't have to go back and say, oh my gosh, I have like, you know, our organization, we have like 1,000 vendors on file and some of them are 2011 W-9s, others are 2014, others are 2017. Do I have to update them all? And you don't. The only thing, the only vendors you have to update are the ones whose information's changed.
Yeah.
And that has to be information that goes to the core of their name and their TIN. So, and typically what I'm talking about there is something like a merger or an acquisition or maybe they changed their structure.
Their legal
structure, they're an entity.
Yes.
Yeah, and so they went from a sole proprietor and maybe they incorporated, or maybe they were a single member LLC and they decided to take in partners and operate as a partnership. Right. Stuff like that. So that's definitely stuff you have to respond to and get an updated W-9. But you know, the IRS last issued a W-9 about a year ago in October of 2018. And, you know, so ideally you've been documenting all your vendors using that particular W-9 since that.
Yeah, I think they're coming out with a new W-9 soon.
You know, it seems like every couple of years they do. And it's mostly because of the issues they have in particular with Box 3.
Yeah.
There's just all kinds of, they've been trying to fine tune that because they have a box there that has two LLC sub boxes in it. And that creates a ton of problems especially because the person completing the form, they typically just guess or wing it. You know, I mean, they don't care. They're like, this is your problem, not mine. and it is your problem.
Right.
I mean, you're the one that has to then go and validate it and see whether they filled it out correctly because, you know, at the end of the year, you complete that information return and that name and TIN has to match up. If it doesn't, then the IRS database will generate a mismatch and now you're dealing with corrections and B notices and potential penalties.
Yeah. All right, Steve, let's take a quick break with a message from our sponsor. And when we come back, maybe we can have two more questions that you're asked over and over again. Okay, so from our sponsor, AP professionals know invoices are easy to lose and it takes time to track down approvers while having to code, log, cross-reference, verify, reconcile, and cut checks, all while staying compliant. Stamply simplifies that. When invoices enter the system, Stamply's AI, called Billy the Bot, immediately gets to work by proposing geocodes, approvers, and flagging issues like PO mismatches and potential duplicates. AP simply confirms the information is correct and submits the invoice for approval. Here's the best part. Stamply fixes the disconnected communications between approvers, AP, and vendors. With Stamply, conversations are centered around each invoice, and anyone can be invited to the conversation, getting to an approval decision up to 5 times faster. Visit stamply.com/AP now. See for yourself how your team can work smarter, not harder. That's stamply.com/AP now. All right, Steve, back to you. So what is the next common question you're asked?
So a question or slash issue.
Yeah.
And I am almost on a like vigilante level vendetta to stamp out a misconception that comes up again and again. I mean, like Charles Bronson or something.
Okay.
Probably dating myself saying Charles Bronson. Yeah. All the younger people are like, who's this guy talking about?
Yeah.
It's there were these movies, Death Wish. They're kind of reactionary, borderline racist, but it's this guy who, you know, went out and basically was shooting up criminals in New York City back in the 70s or whatever. And
not someone
you know,
want to really
like,
emulate.
No, he did. And I actually through the 80s, and there were like 10 of them or something. Mm-hmm. It got ridiculous. The guy was actually a good actor, but it just kind of took over his life, these movies. But he was on this mission to stamp out crime. And so that was the analogy I was
mm-hmm.
trying to make. But
mm-hmm.
I'm on this mission to stamp out. There's this misconception that if you have a payment that's made to a hotel, it gets reported in box one of the 1099 miscellaneous as rent. And it actually does not. It gets reported in box seven. And that has huge implications for your filing because hopefully, as everyone listening in knows, if it's box seven, it's got to be done by the end of January. Whereas if it's box one, well, you know, if you're filing on paper, you got until the end of February. If you're e-filing, you have until the end of March. You don't have to worry about it so quickly. But, you know, I mean, and so I run into this all the time where someone will literally, I'll be doing a webinar and they'll say, well, we did a webinar 6 months ago and the speaker said this. And I'm just like, well, the speaker's wrong. And they
you
are
get yourself popular.
So, I mean they don't want to know that there's a lot of good speakers out there. There are. Just because someone is not a CPA or not a tax attorney or someone who hasn't been doing accounts payable specifically for the last 2 decades doesn't mean they're bad at what they do. But there's also a lot of people out there, if this isn't the core of what they do on a day-to-day level, they're just not necessarily up to speed with all the little intricacies that go into this stuff. And, you know, because they might be speaking on a variety of corporate training topics that tie into HR and payroll and all kinds of other stuff too. And so they have a general level of knowledge from 10,000 feet, but when it comes to reporting, you want someone who's got specific knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is something that, you know, I tell people, I do conferences, do seminars, do whatever it is. I'm like, no, it's box seven reportable. Intuitively, it sounds like it would be rent. You're renting a conference room, for example.
Right.
But, you know, it's not treated that way by the IRS. And so that's another misconception slash question that I get a lot. I get a ton of questions that revolve around all kinds of different aspects of 1099 reporting, though. It's I would say the ones that relate with your big boxes are more, you know, important. You know, so I mean, it's less common that I get a fisherman coming up to me and asking me about, you know, box five issues or something. Although, to be fair, I did a seminar out in Portland, Oregon one time, and there were quite a few fishing boat captains in the audience.
Ah.
It was kind of cool. I mean, because they, you know, I mean, it's a different line of work, and they have a lot of questions about how to report. And there's a different set of rules.
They have a lot of unique issues. Yeah.
Yes. But so does everybody else, though, too. I mean, you know, you're an organization that maybe is involved in processing lawsuits. So you have a lot of box 3, box 7, box 14. You have a lot of 1099 INT questions,
mm-hmm.
And so on and so forth. So that's another thing. I mean, you know, every industry, you know, you're a college or university. You have a lot of questions about resident aliens, you know, because you have a lot mm-hmm. of foreign students or scholars or professors.
And
or
honorariums.
Yes, and honorariums. So, I mean, I could go, you know, but it's hard, you know. I mean, you have all these industries listening in. So in a webinar, you try to hit and touch upon all of those, unless you're doing an industry-specific
right.
webinar, and that's fine. And then that takes me back to my service, because then that person can literally, like, I have some insurance companies that I represent, and that's what they do. They say, okay, that was great. He talked about it in the webinar, but now we're going to join up with his service, and they're going to hit me with a blizzard of questions that relate very much to what they do from an insurance perspective.
Yeah.
And that's fine. That's what I'm here for. But there, you know, so, and that's also hard, because when you ask about, you know, what's the most common question or whatever, what's also hard is in the webinar context, invariably there'll be at least one or two people every webinar I do, you know, in the chat or verbally, they type in or say some very, very specific question that's only going to be applicable to them. And mm-hmm. so, and generally I let them know, hey, shoot me an email outside of this, you know, outside
right.
of the webinar, we'll address it, because pretty much I'm going to put the rest of the listeners to sleep here.
Right.
And so sometimes there's benefits to the format, and there's, I mean, when Mary and I first started doing this, it was, you went on the road and you were in three different cities a week, and that
right.
was not fun.
Right.
So the benefits, I mean, the advantage of that is when you do get a specific question like that, you can talk to the person through lunch or on a break and address it right then and there. The downside is you're literally in one location, you're spending the entire day there, and there's all the other organizations and people you could help versus doing multiple webinars in a day or something.
Right.
So technology has really helped what we do in that regard
right.
and made it easier to be
right.
an educational resource.
Yep.
And that's a good thing.
Yeah. So before we sign off, just real quickly, what was the funniest thing you've ever been asked in relation to 1099 reporting?
So, I mean, you know, I always try to find humor in things.
Right.
I do. And it's really hard to do that with tax. Sometimes I get asked, and if someone asks a simple or basic question, that's important too. So I'm not just going to say, somebody asked this really dumb question.
Right.
I can't believe they don't know this. Well, if you're new to this, or you've only been doing this per se, yeah, if you've only been doing this for like 7 or 8 years, it's still going to be tricky.
I mean,
this is the kind of thing that takes forever to learn. It tends to be situational if there's humor, you
right.
know, and it's going to typically be like a dark humor, like, you know, someone slipped on our sidewalk and their
right.
arm, you know, whatever they slipped on, you know, and you're like, well, whether, you know, they slip on a banana peel or
mm-hmm.
what? Ha ha ha. Mm-hmm. You know, you know, or it's more of interesting.
Right.
So someone will say, well, you know, we hired this entertainer and you recognize the name.
Mm-hmm.
Or we have this athlete that comes in and does this, for example, a tennis charity tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And invariably they're not U.S. I mean, those of us who have watched tennis for a long time remember the days when the best players were American. Nowadays, forget about it.
Yeah.
Other than Serena. Other
right.
than Serena.
Oh,
you know,
Serena, right.
Or the Williams sisters in general on
yeah.
the women's side. On the men's side, we haven't had anyone good in ages, you know, but so they're bringing in, you know, it'll be a Swiss guy, Federer,
right.
or a Spanish guy, Nadal, or something like that. And they're doing a chair. And so they'll ask about that. And you'll be like, so it's more of interesting. And then the other questions I get that are notable would be the ones that are tricky and complicated. And that's actually something I like, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, it makes me think, it makes me go out and look something up and verify it. And I always do that too. You know, that's another, if you're ever attending a webinar and you can tell the speaker's trying to BS their way through a question, that's not a good thing.
No.
You want a speaker who's willing to say, you know what, I don't know for sure right now,
right,
and I want to get you the right answer,
right,
so I'm going to look that up, and I'm going to shoot you an email,
yeah,
about that.
But, I would much, you know, prefer somebody did that.
Yes. Because, you know, but sometimes you get that and people think, oh, I got to give them an answer.
No.
And, no. So the questions I get, rather than the questions being humorous, it's really, I get questions that are notable. And sometimes I get questions that are like those awesome, like, holy cow, you just asked a great question. That's going to be like a light bulb moment for everyone listening in.
Oh,
and those are my
wonderful favorites
too.
Yeah.
Where they ask the kind of question that I can give the kind of answer that ties everything together.
Yep.
And those are the other notable questions I get. But there are no bad questions, and sometimes there are questions you'll chuckle, you'll be like, "Oh, I can't believe you landed in this mess.
Yeah.
How did that happen?" You know? And so internally you're thinking that, you're not telling them that. You're like, "Yeah, like, oh yeah, you're toast. I mean, I can't help you anymore. I mean, you're just going to have to, you know, I'd find a new job. I'd polish up that resume if I were you. I mean, you know, you're not going to do that." But yeah, I mean, sometimes you get those too. You're like, "Oh, ouch. Oh,
right.
You know, I can't believe this is what's going on."
Yeah.
But the nice thing is with the IRS, you always fight them.
Yeah.
That's my go-to. You always fight them. You never roll over. And a lot of times, if you're persistent enough, and you're really showing that you're you know, a responsible filer, you can get to where you want to go. If you can't get a penalty abated, maybe you could get it cut down.
Right.
You know, you could get the interest or the penalties waived. So there's always some play there, and a lot of people always forget that. They forget that, and a lot of times they roll over, and that's not good either.
Yeah. And of course, always be polite when you're dealing with the IRS. Being arrogant,
yes,
doesn't get you anything.
Except, right, because they're going to be there no matter what. They could be at your place or someone else's place. They could be, you know,
right,
assessing a penalty against you or someone else, but it doesn't matter to them. So yeah, being arrogant is the worst thing.
Yeah. Okay, Steve, well, I have to say, I know you didn't mean to, but you entertained me greatly. So for that, I thank you. I hope you'll come back again sometime in the future. And
yes,
to our audience, I want to thank you for listening to this podcast. And a special thanks to our sponsor, Stamply, a leader in AI-powered invoice automation. If you like this podcast, please take a moment to rate this episode, review the episode, subscribe to the series, or even better, share it with your community on LinkedIn, Facebook, or wherever. To be alerted to new episodes, please sign up for a free twice-a-week e-zine. It also contains tips and news of upcoming AP Now webinars, article postings, and more. Hope to see you again soon on another AP Now podcast.